Reaction to Governor Paul LePage's State of the State Address. Governor LePage returned to some familiar themes last night, including his goals to cut taxes, reduce energy costs, and streamline Maine school districts. But there were some new themes as well, most notably a frustration with Maine's referendum process. LePage says that recent referenda have made the legislature, quote, irrelevant, and he believes out-of-state activists are driving a progressive agenda. The governor also called for a statewide teachers' contract and higher pay for Maine teachers. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss the governor's priorities, their chances of becoming law, and the tone he set during the State of the State address. What did you think of the speech? What did you hear or not hear? Maine Calling is next. First, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Last night, Governor Paul LePage delivered his State of the State address. He took aim at the state's referendum process, sought to portray himself as a defender of Maine's elderly, and leveled broad shots at liberals and their desire to, quote, transform our state into a socialist utopia. I have three guests with me today to share their reaction to the governor's address. Cynthia Dill is a civil rights lawyer and former Democratic state senator, Mike Chinquette, former counsel to Governor Paul LePage and deputy counsel. He works as an in-house counsel and financial manager for a number of affiliated companies in southern Maine. And Dick Woodbury is a Yarmouth Independent, and he served in the state representative as a state representative and as a state senator from 2010 to 2014. As always, we want to hear from you as well. What stood out to you from last night's State of the State address? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Mike, Cynthia, Dick, welcome.
Good to be here.
Let's kick off here with an excerpt from the very top of last night's speech, which kind of captures one of the governor's main themes.
I am here tonight to speak to the Maine people. Our economy and our way of life is under attack. Older Mainers who have worked their entire lives are losing their homes because of tax and utility bills, and many local governments condone it. Sadly, Maine Municipal Association defends it. The taxes Mainers have paid all their lives fund organizations that throw them out on the street. It has to stop.
Okay, the very first line there, Mike Chinquette, before we get to the plight of the elderly, is, I'm here tonight to speak to the Maine people. It was almost as if he was saying, I'm looking right over the top of your heads and into the camera and into the living rooms of those of you watching out there. Was that a deliberate message?
You know, I certainly think it was deliberate. The legislature gets to engage with the governor on a daily basis. The Maine people in this setting don't. And one of the, I think, changes we've seen in policymaking over the past few years is this reliance on people's referendum by various interest groups and so forth. So I think the governor did have a deliberate strategy to say, if the people want to be the lawmakers, I'll address the new lawmakers in our state.
But the language about our state is under attack and the and the elderly are the victims, Cynthia, this is also trying to create some drama around the plight of the elderly for whom he is positioning himself as champion.
It sounds a lot like Donald Trump's carnage in America. I mean, the real echoes of the Trump speeches, I think pitting Maine people against, outsiders in his mind. But in my view, the whole speech was really directed at the Maine people because he's beginning his run for U.S. Senate. I mean, we're just seeing this sort of stepping out of Paul LePage. He looks different. He acts different. It was a really good speech, I thought. It was very effective, engaging, contradictory in many respects, but it was a campaign speech.
Dick, as an economist, I'm sure you're aware of the special pressures that elderly Mainers face in a state where they're on fixed incomes and energy costs are high and there's a foreclosure problem with property taxes and some of these larger, older houses. But is this a partisan issue?
Well, I don't think it's a partisan issue other than
any politician, you know, wants to focus on real world, real people examples of the policies that that are impacted by the policies that they're trying to advance. So it's a common approach in politics to focus on people who are going through a difficult time and what the matter is with the policies that are in place right now, and how to fix it. So I think the governor did that well last night. With compassion for the people involved, I think the governor presented himself well. But I also think that he described the reasons that he believes what he believes better than he usually does as well. So I thought overall this speech was an effective speech.
Mike, he takes a shot there at the Maine Municipal Association, effectively saying, look, you know, old Mrs. Smith is out on her keister and the people at MMA don't seem to care. What's behind that?
Well, you know, it's a few things. First is, and it wasn't Mrs. Smith, there was a couple there from Albion who had their home foreclosed on by the town for back taxes of approximately $6,000. And, you know, one of the things the governor did, and kudos to him and the administration, was help this gentleman find out he was eligible for VA benefits having served in Vietnam. We're able to get him those things he was entitled to. That doesn't help get his house back, but it's, you know, it's progress. One of the challenges I think the governor's had with Maine Municipal, and having been a mayor, he's seen the other side of the coin as well, is, you know, the towns, not unlike the states and not unlike everyone else in the world, they want resources, they want money, and they want no accountability and no strings. So it's this natural tension between state government and municipal government on, you know, whoever's paying the bill, whose rules have to be followed.
Well, I mean, I think Maine Municipal Association has a legitimate argument that under the LePage administration, municipal revenue sharing has decreased, and Maine towns and cities depend on a certain percentage, supposed to be 5%, of the state income tax to fund social programs. And as more and more programs are put on towns under the LePage administration, including the school costs of retirement, including a lot of costs associated with education, I think the towns rightfully have said, look, you either have to give us our revenue sharing or do something to lower property taxes. If Governor LePage was serious about helping elders in Maine, he could release the bond money that an overwhelming majority of Maine people approved to help fund elderly housing. He could increase, tax revenue sharing for municipalities, which goes directly towards, people in these local programs. The minimum wage issue, he always makes a direct line between minimum wage and hurting elderly people. But in fact, many elderly people in Maine work minimum wage jobs. So I thought he delivered the speech very well. But when you scratch the surface, the policies were unachievable, and the problems that he complains of are largely his responsibility.
Well, and he took aim at liberals here more than a few times, Cynthia, and we have another excerpt from the speech in which he talks about how liberals are trying to change the Maine that he grew up in.
Maine was once renowned for its rugged individualism. Liberals are now trying to transform our state into a socialist utopia. Utopia is an ideology. No amount of taxpayer money will make it a reality.
All right, Cynthia, we'll start with you. How is the socialist utopia going?
Well, I mean, if you look at the Maine landscape, child poverty rates have increased. The economy has not done well under the LePage administration. And the reality is the taxes that come into the state coffers are largely from these so-called liberals from southern Maine. So he wants it both ways. You know, he wants to attack constantly people in urban areas, but he has no problem, you know, collecting all the tax revenues and distributing them out to the hinterlands. And also he makes a message of, oh, Maine has to attract young entrepreneurs, business types. And yet he has created this brand of Maine being this sort of provincial racist state that doesn't welcome people from away. So I think the governor, like I said, he delivers a good line, but when push comes to shove, he's largely responsible for, creating a dystopia in Maine as opposed to people trying to do good for Maine's kids and otherwise be responsible in government.
Dick, how much of this is the socialist movement, the socialist utopia, really a reference to southern Maine and Portland? How much of this is a two Maines thing versus the sort of difference between ideologies?
I guess I don't interpret it so much as a geographic issue. I think it's more the broader divisions in our political philosophies that really span the whole country right now, where you can have the most popular, successful politicians, and I'm thinking Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders as being really at the ends, that they're stimulating passions of people who really care deeply about some political philosophy, but it's stimulating division as opposed to some common unity of understanding. And certainly the governor participates in that when he speaks with words like socialist and liberal as if they're swear words.
Yeah, those are intentionally being used as pejoratives there, Mike, liberal and socialist.
They are. One of the challenges, and it's interesting, Cynthia mentions it's, this geographic thing. I think the one that distills it the most is question two, which was the 3% tax surcharge. And, I guess I'd push back on Cynthia a bit, because many of those affluent southern Maine towns, Cape Elizabeth, Falmouth, and so forth, oppose those. They're actually aligned with the governor on how the tax policy should come out. I think really what you're seeing is kind of this deviation between, as he said, this kind of classic rugged individualism that Maine historically was known for, whether real or imagined, that was certainly the perception many had. And things like, when Governor Baldacci was in, they had Dirigo Health, which ultimately didn't change the needle significantly on Maine's uninsured population, but significantly grew the roles of folks on government-assisted health care. So I think you're seeing the governor talk about some of these well-intended policies not necessarily having the effect they're promised to.
I'm sorry, rugged individualism. I mean, Governor LePage presided over, the $40 million or whatever it was, $16 million total corporate welfare for Kate Street Capital. I mean, last year the legislature approved something like a $13 million subsidy for the biomass industry in the northern parts of the state. I mean, he distributes income taxes along ideology, ideological lines, as good as any social utopian I've ever known. I mean, he takes money from one pocket and puts it in another. And this idea that somehow it's rugged individualism for these corporations to just take our money and run is just a joke.
Well, that's a good segue then into this third clip here I want to play. This is another major theme of the speech, which I'm paraphrasing here, but basically, it suggests, hey, don't go after the wealthy because they do a lot for the Maine economy.
They pay sales tax, excise tax, income tax, property tax. They pay 2/3 of the revenues that come into the coffers of the state of Maine.
Yeah, they being the liberals.
10% of our population pays 2/3 of the tax burden. Taxing them out of our state and hurting our economy is not the right thing to do.
All right, Dick, you're the economist. This was not my strongest subject, but is this something akin to trickle down? That is, making sure the wealthy are in a good place so that they can bestow the benefits upon us?
Well, Keith, you usually want me to focus my comments on politics and policy, but I do think the issue of of disproportionately high taxes in one state versus another state can lead to some mobility issues. And it's a different issue when you're talking about federal tax policy. When you raise taxes on wealthy people as a national policy, you don't generally lead people or businesses to decide they're going to move their operations out of the country, or particularly residents to move out of the country. But states do get reputations, and at times when people are moving, when they're deciding where to locate their business, when they're deciding where to retire, I think tax rates can make a difference.
So he had mentioned, Cynthia, that he had spoken to people who said they weren't going to come here, or they were going to close up shop and move their practice out of state. Is that something that factors into a wealthier professional thinking about where they're going to set up and live, as the income tax rate?
Well, there's always going to be anecdotes to back up whatever political philosophy you're operating under, at the moment. And of course, people are influenced by tax rates. But I think the overwhelming research suggests that businesses and individuals use other factors besides the tax rates to make these important decisions. There's quality of life decisions. I mean, there's all kinds of factors that go into it. For businesses, it's number one, a trained workforce, as opposed to, this slight differential in tax rates among states. But The bottom line is, he said at the beginning of his speech, he's speaking to the people. The people came out and voted for the referendum question that increased the tax rates on the wealthy. Now, it's true. My town voted against it. I personally voted against it. But you can't have it both ways. You can't say, you know, you're for the people, and yet the people come out and speak, and he says, no, I know better than them.
Well, he said, I think last night, Mike, that they did – he acknowledged, and he said he gets it. They voted for it. But he said they probably didn't read the actual legislation because they didn't understand the ill effects it would have on the economy.
Well, that's right. You know, one of the challenges with the referendum process is voters are given three lines on a large piece of legislation and said and asked yes or no. You know, voters also voted to remove any penalties for underage use of marijuana because the drafters of that bill had goofed it up, so the legislature has gone and fixed it. So this idea that the underlying intent can be respected while some of the, you know, second and third order effects can be addressed is true. You know, one of the things, you know, to Cynthia's point, while the businesses themselves don't certainly taxes play in it, but it's one piece of many others. But to attract that trained workforce, I certainly agree with Dick. Tax considerations are real. If you're a mid-level manager at a semiconductor company and have the choice between Arizona or South Portland, Maine, you know, it costs you probably 8% of your pay to live in South Portland, Maine. And, you know, that's a real effect and has an effect on attracting that trained workforce.
To the larger question of how these two initiatives became law in the first place, the governor took aim at the referendum process. And he described at one point yesterday the legislature as irrelevant because progressive forces from out of state had had taken over the referendum process and used it to bypass the legislature to push their own agenda. And then secondly, he would call for some changes in this because he sort of portrayed this as, well, you know, because there are so many people and so many progressives in Portland and southern Maine, they can easily head over to the Walmart on election day and get an initiative on the ballot, whereas it's much harder in Washington County to do the same thing because of these other factors. Cynthia, how do you respond to that? Do we need to change the Constitution to level the playing field on the initiative process?
Well, if we're going to open up the Constitution to make changes to reflect, you know, a better way to govern, let's change the Second Amendment. I mean, these people who wave around the Constitution when it supports their political agenda, it always has to be textually adhered to as if it's some, you know, religious, you know, scroll. But the governor apparently just wants to rip up that portion of the Constitution that gives people the right to put things on a referendum. And if he wants to make the case to make tweaks to the law around the referendum process, he has to get Democrats on board because they have the majority in the House. And so in a speech that just attacks liberals, and he's pointing right at all of the Democrats who come from the southern part of the state, you know, I just don't see how he actually achieves his goals. So it's a lot of rhetoric and sounds like a good idea, but it's he did nothing to actually move the ball.
But Dick, as an independent, and you had others in the ideological spectrum behind an initiative that you were involved in that was passed by the legislature, I'm going to get by the people. I'm going to guess you would disagree with his take.
Well, I have a lot of respect for the ability of the people to participate in direct democracy. So you're right. I'm worried about our referendum process getting overused. But the other thing that I was thinking last night that I thought the governor did such a good job communicating last night that if he was sort of talking about, here's my policy game plan for the next 2 years, and he said, I'm going to put it on a referendum, and then he gave that speech and the speech that he gave last night, and then everybody voted, I think he'd have had a shot of winning that way. I mean, it's almost like he was going to the people he should like the referendum process.
All right. We'll hear a little bit more from the governor after we take a quick break. This is Maine Calling. The number to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Humanities Council's Think and Drink series on the definition of a criminal, February 28th, Space Gallery in Portland, mainehumanities.org. And Condo Furniture by Endicott Home, offering non-toxic solutions for downsizing and living well in smaller spaces. CondoFurniture.com.
Hi, it's Steve Inskeep with NPR News. You know, it's never been so easy to stay connected to the news. And maybe it's never been so hard to understand what it all means and what really matters. That's where Maine Public Radio and NPR News are so valuable to you and so valuable to this community. Our reporters, editors, and producers around the world work to slow the news down. Information is coming at us so quickly. We want to grab a piece of information out of that fast-moving flow. Think about it a little while. Ask a few more questions. Figure out what's really going on. Investigate. Above all, listen. Anytime and anywhere you listen, you get reliable, thorough news and information you can use on a daily basis. You're learning along with us. We're all figuring out the world together. And when you call or go online today, your contribution will support that effort for you and for this community. And the contribution will be counted toward the Super Thursday one-day membership drive.
Super Thursday coming up tomorrow, February 9th, but you can contribute right now at mainpublic.org or by calling 800-866-1475. And coming up at 2 o'clock in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour, a rebroadcast of last night's State of the State Address by Governor Paul LePage here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, reaction to last night's State of the State Address. In the studio with me, Dick Woodbury, a Yarmouth Independent who served as a state representative and state senator, Cynthia Dill, a civil rights attorney and former Democratic state senator, and Mike Chinquette, former counsel to Governor Paul LePage. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. One more clip here from last night that speaks, I think, a little bit to the tone and his suggesting that he is open to working with the legislature.
We need to take back our government. We need to say we have a responsibility to those who elected us, and we have to do our jobs for the people who elected us. And, you know, if you've got a monkey in your shoulder, you've got to knock him off and get on with the work. So I ask you tonight, over the next 2 years, I ask you, do no harm. Do no harm to the economy. Let's try to figure out a way that we can work together.
Dick, as compared to last year when there was no speech at all because he didn't feel like he could even look at the legislature, that's sort of a big change and sort of an opening of the door.
I've seen the governor speak quite a number of times now, and there's a spectrum. And at his worst, he is angry and can't get along with anybody. And at the other end of the spectrum, he is open and calm and almost thoughtful, and he was much closer to that end last night, and that clip showed it.
Yeah, Mike?
Yeah, I think he's more than almost thoughtful, but, you know, one of the interesting things, you know, it was, I would say, his first or second best state of the state, and the most astounding thing for those who watch Maine politics closely were his shout-outs to Troy Jackson at the very end. His foil in prior years, when Troy returned to the Senate and took over leadership, the governor and he have buried the hatchet and see eye to eye on some issues and appear to be working together. And that's one of the things I think, you know, his other state of the state that sticks out to me was his first with Barry Hobbins and Emily Kane as the respected Democratic leaders, who were two people the governor could work with very well. So I think he's seeing some good faith from the other side, and with that, he's responding.
All right, let's take some calls now. We'll go to first to Jesse in Portland. Hi, Jesse.
Hi. First off, I want to say I'm a local liberal, progressive, socialist senior from Southern Maine. And last night, the governor of Northern Maine continued to scapegoat his implied bad poor of Maine by seeming to say that the only worthy poor are the elderly and disabled. Being a senior, I remember the same type rhetoric against the liberal JFK's anti-poverty program in the 1960s. Since then, seeming reactionaries like Governor LePage and his appointee to head the DHS, Mayhew, have succeeded in turning that anti-poverty dream into an anti-poor people's nightmare. And by contrast, he seems enamored with the rich and wants them to stay, whereas I'd like to see those rich who are reactionary obstructionists and anti-poor and who don't want to pay their fair share leave Maine and free up some housing for the poor and middle class, especially here in Portland, and maybe the gentrification in Maine would cease.
Okay.
Lastly,
yeah,
God bless Elizabeth Warren, who last night channeled Coretta King through the ladder, through the latter's letter of warning. Go women's movement.
All right, Jesse.
That's all I've got to say.
Thank you. Let's go to anyone. Any thoughts on that? Okay. Let's go to Frank in Brunswick. Hi, Frank.
Yes. Good afternoon. First, I'd like to take issue with the last caller. I was part of the anti-poverty program. In fact, I was one of the first people hired to put Project Head Start on the map. And I think historically, the gentleman who just called is wrong, way off the base. Anyway, what I really called about was touching on a theme that the governor mentioned, which really most people tend to ignore, and that's he's talked about cheap energy and how to bring cheap energy into the state the way they're bringing it into Vermont and the way it's made Quebec's economy hum. And that's either generating our own by renovating existing hydropowered mills that have been that need to be restored or else bringing it in through Hydro-Quebec. And this would also have an economic apply. It's not a big increase in demand for some businesses, but Infotech businesses really like to have that nice, clean power that you can get through things like hydropower. We've been through the wind thing. We've been through the solar thing, and we realize that they've got a lot of liabilities. And as anybody who's Marine Portland Press Herald has noticed, the cost of electricity for both commercial and business owners is skyrocketing. So that's just basically the point is that I think energy should be really highlighted some more, and it should be specified, and I think the governor could get into some of the details of it.
All right, Frank, thank you. The governor did say last night, Mike, that he's willing to entertain any form of energy as long as it works. And he sort of suggested, look, why don't we start by coming up with mutual goals, that is to lower the cost, lower the carbon footprint or damage done, and to become less reliant on oil, and then become agnostic to the form and simply let the market decide.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I think the governor, you know, reached out, and he has over the past few years, as Frank mentioned, you know, been certainly a proponent of hydro. But last night he said, okay, let's agree on the hill to take, and then we'll take it together. You know, as was mentioned, the Press Herald did a very interesting story on the energy costs in Maine, particularly transmission and distribution and those pieces, and how that impacts, you know, it certainly impacts the consumer and the household. But really, a company like Hudimaki in Waterville, which makes Chinet and is a substantial employer, they're seeing their energy bill go up 20%. And when we're competing on tax policy, when we're competing on energy policy, we don't have a Tennessee Valley Authority. We don't have a Hoover Dam. Dickie Lincoln never got built. So finding a way to make ourselves competitive in that market would be a significant differentiator.
Dick, is part of the issue, though, energy prices right now are relatively low as compared to what they have been in the past and what many project are in the future. So it's kind of a moving target here in terms of your future planning.
Well, it is. It does seem that we've been on a fairly steady path toward increased diversity of where we're getting our energy from. And in many ways, almost naturally, and that is what free markets do, is that they do move toward, you know, what become the most efficient technologies. And so I get a sense that we're automatically going to transition to some degree toward where the least expensive thing is going to be. But I, listening to the governor last night, I'm interested in learning more about options that are out there.
Let's go to Cynthia, another Cynthia, in Chesterville. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi. So you've moved on a little from the point that I originally was calling about, but I'll just weigh in on as to whether or not the governor's speech was spectacular in any way. I found it overall incoherent and uncomfortable to listen to because he's just so random and so lashes out in such random ways and so on. But there were a few good points. Like, I think the energy thing is going in the right direction, perhaps. He seems open-minded, and I really support renewables. But the one thing I wanted to call that I was calling about initially was, you know, with respect to, you know, the referendum question, too, about incomes over $200,000 having the higher tax rate applied. I just find it strange that it's very seldom pointed out that the tax rate, the higher tax rate, only applies to the amount of that income that's over $200,000, not for the first $200,000, but the amount above $200,000. And that never comes up in conversation, so it's easy to rant about how you're taking advantage of and driving such people away. And overall, the overall concern that the governor always shows for the wealthy and the and corporations and businesses in general leaves me a little bit cold.
All right, Cynthia, thank you for joining us. Many thoughts?
Well, one thought is just in terms of the earlier caller that mentioned skyrocketing energy costs. I mean, that's just not true. Energy costs are not skyrocketing. They're flattening out or decreasing. It's just that ratepayers aren't seeing necessarily a decrease in their bills because of the cost of infrastructure. And as far as energy subsidies go, I mean, government is always picking winners and losers. There is no free market whatsoever when it comes to energy. And again, example is just last session, the legislature passed a law that gave like over $13 million in subsidies to the biomass industry. I mean, whether it's solar or energy, you know, all of these energy interests have lobbyists that, you know, tweak laws to get ahead. There is no free market when it comes to energy.
1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Robin in Falmouth. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank
Thanks
you.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. So I have a couple points. I'll try to keep it pretty narrow. I do think leaving the state of Maine is real for people. I do think we have high energy costs, high real estate costs, you know, arguably the highest, depending on where your income is, but very high taxes. New Hampshire is also beautiful with a quality of life. So I think that's real, and I think we need to remember that it was a very narrow margin that approved this question. The other thing I'm just objecting to is just the separation. I think we all need to come together a little bit more and look for our common interests and beliefs of supporting the elderly and giving people appropriate social supports and stop assuming that we're all liberal in the South and conservative in the North. I think a lot of us don't fit the labels here. And we need to move away from these stereotypes and realize we have a lot of independents and a lot of people that have some common ground but might disagree on certain topics.
Yeah, Robin, thank you. A lot of people agree with Robin that why are we doing this? But it is safe to say that the political machine on both sides recognizes some of the value of isolating and separating and vilifying, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because it works and it raises money.
Well, and Paula Page is just an excellent campaigner. I mean, he really stinks at governing. He can't get anything through the legislature. He can't get anything of his agenda passed. But he's a great campaigner and he's a great messenger. But what he basically made clear in his speech was that he finds no common ground with this group that he has, you know, labeled liberals. He's created an enemy. He always has to have an enemy, and it's liberals, and the personification of that is now the House Speaker, Sarah Gideon. So he has his enemy that he can fight against in what he sort of describes as this gallant battle of him fighting for the people who go to work every day. But meanwhile, his agenda actually is to cut taxes for, you know, the people in my town and increase taxes for, you know, lower income family. So it's a tricky path that he walks, but he does it.
Mike, he has 2 years left. He's been working on this for some time, this agenda. And as Dick said, if he had maybe taken a slightly different tack, he could have used last night's speech to move this forward and actually get some things done. He does seem to not be so concerned about that. When he seems to be moving toward a conciliatory point or tactically getting something passed, he then sort of slips back sometimes and becomes more adversarial.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's a bit of a dance because when the speech ended and the House let out, they all went over to the Blaine House, and I'm sure there was probably a cocktail or two and good times were had by all. You know, one of the challenges is you're speaking to multiple audiences all at the same time. You're speaking to those Republicans in the legislature who the governor will need to support him through vetoes. And there is a cadre that will, but in order to first do no harm and stop bad policy, he needs them rallied and fired up while, as he did with the opiate issue, with the energy issue and a few others, you know, reach out and find some areas where there may be opportunities to work together. But there are areas where Democrats and Republicans and conservatives and liberals and whatever label you want to choose, there will be areas of disagreement that are probably not surmountable. And so be it. So if the governor can rally his troops to hold the line, he wins.
One of those issues on which they may work together and talked a little bit about this is the opioid crisis. We'll talk about that after, though, we take a quick break. 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Mark in Porter, we promise, when we come back. This is Maine Calling. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
Hi, it's Mark Vogelsang, CEO of Maine Public. We're doing all we can to ensure that Maine Public Radio provides you with the best service we possibly can offer, a service that features our new lineup of NPR news shows and critical information. Today, there are more reasons than ever before to lend your support. More choice, more essential NPR journalism, more news programs. We're doing what we can to make Maine Public Radio live up to all that you want us to be. Listeners like you play a crucial role to keep this independent news service strong. So please stand up and be counted. You can do that on Super Thursday, our one-day membership campaign on February 9th. Whether it's joining me in becoming a sustaining monthly Evergreen supporter or becoming a new contributor, together we can do this and help pay for the news that we all care about. Of course, you can also pledge online right now, this second, and have it count toward our Super Thursday goals at mainpublic.org. Thanks.
And join us coming up in 20 minutes in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour, a rebroadcast of last night's State of the State address by Governor Paul LePage. Again, that's in 20 minutes in our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, reaction to last night's State of the State address. In the studio with me, Mike Chinquette, former counsel to Governor Paul LePage, Dick Woodbury, a Yarmouth Independent who served as a state rep and state senator, and Cynthia Dill, a civil rights attorney and former Democratic state senator. Join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Mark in Porter. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, good afternoon, Keith. Thanks for taking my call. It was great to hear the governor speak last night. It's definitely a lot easier to watch him speak rather than read his letters. But I was concerned with his statements. It's easy to state facts with regards to the opioid epidemic out in these outlying rural communities, but this has been happening now for a good couple of years, and finally he's realizing the desperation there. And it's easy to state the facts with the amount of lives that are lost every year to opioid addiction, but he needs to put some money where his mouth is and move ahead to some of these addiction programs. It really is disturbing.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Mike, he was resistant to the treatment side, or at least he wanted to emphasize the enforcement side. He did push through some extra enforcement capacity after a couple of years of trying to urge the legislature on. Now, though, it looks like the crisis is there. It's a real scrambling mode here to try to do something. And what we heard last night was he's not sure yet what works.
Well, I think it's more than that. You know, the enforcement piece, for the governor, listening to him speak and hearing from him is, you need to enforce. One, supply is a piece. But the other side of it, with people who are users, getting them into treatment often requires getting them to that point, whether it's a drug court, whether it's some other outside thing helping to drive them. It's very difficult for those who are suffering from addiction to wake up one morning and say, okay, I'm going to stop doing this now. So the enforcement piece was to hopefully lead to ultimate treatment areas. I'd challenge the prior caller. The governor did find within existing budgets no legislative action necessary, over $3 million in new treatment that's already going to affect. But I think, like energy, the governor saying, look, we'll be agnostic to any treatment solution, but we'll judge them all by how they work on getting people clean and getting people back to productive lives.
Yeah. Cynthia, what's your take on the prospects of some sort of significant response to this on a bipartisan basis to this drug issue?
There has to be a meeting of the minds, and it appears that the governor is, I guess, not willing to work with Southern liberals. And, in the cities in Portland is where we have a real problem with opioid crisis. So his inability to work with people who may have solutions is problematic. He talks a good game, but he can't get the deal done. And an expansion of Medicaid or increased treatment, you know, that it's not like that was some questionable, you know, socialist utopian theory about treating addiction. It was science, and he's rejected it for several years now. And so he owns this opioid addiction. It's not the legislature that he tried to delegitimize last night who's been trying to provide solutions. He's I think, as far as I'm concerned, in large part responsible for the state's inability to have a quick and effective reaction to the crisis. He hasn't been able to work with other governors. He hasn't been able to work with the legislature. And so and we're paying the price.
And at the risk of sounding incredibly cold, since this is such a major public health issue, but does the fact that another election is up in 2 years and this crisis seems to be unsolved, Dick, does it, that at least maybe fuel some energy toward solving it that might not otherwise be there?
Well, I've always been troubled that this thing this controversy seems to have erupted as a political fight between those who want to address the issue with law enforcement and those who want to address it with treatment, when clearly some of both and maybe a lot of both is where we ought to be landing. And I guess I want to stay with some optimism that there will be some significant new resources devoted to this on both sides. Again, sure, I try to identify the types of spending that work best, but inaction clearly can't be the answer.
All right, let's go to Michael in Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate the conversation, and I like the different perspectives. But last night I was hearing about education, which I haven't heard discussed yet on the show. And my family and I just moved from Illinois about a year and a half ago, and so we're one of those young families that is educated and trained, and he's trying to promote to come to the state. And so we're here, but we did take substantial pay cuts in order to come here. But the quality of life is better, and the opportunities for our kids is something that we think is better. So when he did mention to make sure that we're, you know, paying our teachers and our nurses and all the positive things about education is good to hear. But I would also like to, you know, see or hear more about how to go about doing that and how to go about turning around the schools, which everyone can agree on, but we didn't really get many specifics on that yesterday.
One idea, thank you, Michael. One of the ideas, Mike, is a statewide teacher's contract, which evens the playing field in terms of pay and disparities of salary amongst poorer and more wealthy school districts. What kind of a chance would that have?
You know, I think it's an uphill battle, to put it charitably. And you know, Michael, welcome to Maine. I'm a year and a half late on that, but it's great when other people come to town. But one of the things I think you've seen, you know, from the governor, and while he didn't get into the details of it necessarily in the speech last night, if you go read his budget and go hear from Rob Hassan, who's the commissioner of education currently. One of the things the governor does want to do is incentivize, rather than penalize as we had in the past, incentivize opportunities for regionalization. One of the challenges in Maine is that we are probably over-infrastructured on the educational side, and that's, you know, heating buildings is expensive, having admin staff is expensive, having all the accoutrements around education we have a lot of with a declining student population. So while he didn't get into it a lot last night, I think if you delve a little bit deeper into some of the things that the administration is saying and proposing, you'd see a lot of that. Now, whether that's the right way to go, you know, we'll see. And certainly the teachers union didn't seem too enthused about the idea of a single contract.
Cynthia, go ahead.
Well, I mean, the question is, does Governor LePage believe in local education control or not? I mean, he fights the common Common Core, everything that comes from a national level or a statewide level or some proposal by perhaps a teachers union that expands the state is shot down because, no, we have to have local control. And yet the governor's trying to impose from the top down some sort of negotiation with teachers, which is, you know, flies in the face of local control. His other proposal in round education was just eliminate the EPS formula, which is difficult to understand. And it's, you know, it's a complicated policy, but it's been by his own people. Governor LePage paid to have a study done, and this education formula in Maine is actually lauded and thought to be one of the best you know, in the region, if not the country. So his solution to, I think, education issues is he wants to have accountability, which everyone supports. But there's no concrete action steps that are even on the landscape. I mean, he's not going to be able to renegotiate all the union contracts before he leaves office. It's just going to be left to the towns who are already trying to scramble. And his suggestions around the funding proposal are not good. So he is trying to just delegitimize teachers' unions in the mold of Scott Walker, and it's really him being against unions and not so much being for education reform, because if it was about education reform, he would work with the commission that's trying to implement the report that he himself, you know, wanted done in the first place.
I'm a little more open-minded about this, particularly when – I mean, the times that you can implement significant reforms is when you – add money to something, and the governor certainly talked a lot. Well, I don't know about a lot, but he made clear that he thinks teachers aren't paid enough; they should be paid more. And if so, part of this notion of reorganizing the teacher contracts is inserting into it the ability to actually pay people more. I think there's, you know, it's open for more discussion.
Well, everybody wants teachers to be paid more, but right, the question is where you get it. You know, where does the money come from? He's refused to support the legislature's efforts to getting the state to pay 55% of, you know, the costs of education. So I just don't see where the money come from. And the EPS formula sort of supposed to address the differential in cost of living for teachers. And so roughly across the board, they should be making, you know, the same. So I think nobody is opposed to paying teachers more. It's just that whether or not the solutions he's putting forth are doable. The one state teacher contract sounds so simple and beautiful. I mean, who could be against it? But the question is, is it achievable? No. So is it a good idea? Probably not.
Right, let's go to David in Falmouth. Hi, David. We're changing the subject slightly here.
Yes, I am. I'm just flabbergasted that somebody who's supposed to be an elderly such as myself is saying that we're better off to eliminate income tax, which, as I'm getting ready to retire, I will not have much income. And I have paid income on all my income my whole life. And now he's going to shift it to sales tax, which I'm going to have to pay sales tax on plowing my driveway, having wood delivered for heating. I mean, it's just such a regressive tax. I mean, the income tax is a good progressive tax, and it should be supported.
Mike, can we put you in the position of being the defender of the income tax, or at least explain what the governor's thinking here is about why he feels so strongly about eliminating the income tax?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things, and you know, David, it's a fair point, and it's an argument that will continue. But you know, as Dick said, there's, you know, if you accept that progressiveness in taxes is something that should happen, and again, that's a debate unto itself, you know, the federal tax structure is different than a state tax structure. One of the things we face in Maine is not only do we have the most second homes in the country, particularly from people who are not residents, you know, we're a tourist mecca, and there's a lot of Mainers, you know, of means who would otherwise probably pay the new 2-3% surcharge imposed by Question 2 who, you know what? When they retire, if they've been successful, they may go pick up residency in Arizona, in Florida, you know, other states, and poof, they're not subject to our income tax. But if they spend 5 months in Maine, if they spend 6 months in Maine, they're paying their sales tax, they're paying all those things. So while I certainly think, Dave, your point's well taken, there needs to be, you know, consideration and structure around tax reform that doesn't penalize those Mainers who are, you know, on fixed incomes and those things if we move to a sales tax-based approach. The underlying concept helps spread the burden beyond those of us who choose to live here.
Dick, what does a state look like? I mean, we've seen, you know, New Hampshire, I guess, but – or not New Hampshire, but – what does a state like Maine look like without an income tax?
Well, I mean, I'm not exactly sure, but I, you know, I've argued the point that Michael just made, you know, often that we have, I don't know, something like 20 million people who spend time here in Maine that aren't residents, and we got 1.3 million who are residents, and among those 20 million or whatever the number is who come and spend some time here, there are people who spend as much as 6 months of the year here. You know, or at least a whole season, or, you know, significant amounts of time, and they're totally exempt from our income tax. And so, it's always struck me that if we structured our tax system better, we could draw a fairer share from that broader group.
Oh, it's just the same broken record every year. So if everybody agrees that we need to lower the income tax rate and expand the sales tax base, then what we really need is for political leaders to get it done. And Paula Page is the leader in Maine, and he cannot get that across the finish line. The Democrats did a tax reform package. The Republicans repealed it, you know, in a referendum question, I might add. And now we're stuck with the dysfunctional taxes. And again, this is Paula Page's legacy. He broke what was a maybe not perfect, but tax reform fix, and he has been unable to replace it.
Let's go to just about a minute left here. We'll go to Steve in Orono. Hi, Steve. Steve, are you there? No, I don't hear Steve. I don't know. Steve,
I'm sorry, I was on mute.
Oh, okay. Okay. Go ahead.
And I guess, look, I've heard it. I'm kind of with Cynthia on this. You can have the best ideas in the world, but if you can't ask people for their help and admit that maybe you did something wrong, I mean, all I've listened to since he's been in is that he's right and everybody's wrong. You have all those, 200 or 300 people there that he needs to work with, and he only could find one person that he could shout out that, you know, hey, you know, nice guy. That's the problem. The governor's in a silo, and when you hear a messenger with that tone and tenor, which he's used all through his governorship, the first thing he did is turn half the people off in the room. I don't care how positive you want to try to be, and I'm trying to be. He can't get anything done because he doesn't have the leadership skills to get people to work with them.
All right. And with that, we're out of time. I appreciate it. Thank you, Steve, for that final thought. And Cynthia, Mike, and Dick, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Cynthia Dill, a civil rights attorney and former Democratic state senator. Mike Ginquette, former counsel to Governor Paul LePage. He works as in-house counsel and financial manager for a number of affiliated companies in Southern Maine. And Dick Woodbury, a Yarmouth independent. He served as a state representative and state senator. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8 o'clock. Visit maincalling.net for past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we'll hear from former legislative aides on the best way to get in touch with and possibly influence your elected representatives. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.